Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone, and yes, that's AC/DC. You'll find out why in just a minute. Over the past few years, breakthroughs and discoveries in quantum physics and astrophysics have been making international headlines. Think Higgs boson or gravitational waves. Many of us struggle to understand what these advances mean or why we should even care. But now a new book attempts to explain all of that with the help, wait for it, of heavy metal. Philip Moriarty is professor of physics at the University of Nottingham and author of When the Uncertainty Principle Goes to 11, or How to Explain Quantum Physics with Heavy Metal. He joins me now via Skype. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I'm thoroughly looking forward to this and explaining the wonders of metal and quantum physics.
Well, it has already made our day a little bit more fun getting to play a little bit of AC/DC there.
But... Absolutely. I was drumming away, air drumming in the background as it was playing.
Now, you write in the book that your key motivation, quote, in writing this book is to bring the beauty of quantum physics to a wider audience via the medium of metal. I mean, why metal specifically? Why not just music?
So a number of different reasons for that, a number of motivations. So I can think of at least three. The first is, so I lecture, I've been a lecturer now since, a long time, 97 I started. So what gives me great pleasure as each new academic year starts, and that will happen on Monday actually here, is as I watch undergraduate students file into the lecture theatre and I can count up the number of different metal t-shirts, you know, the Metallicas, the Slayers, the Sabbaths, the Deep Purple, the Zeppelins, even occasionally a Rush t-shirt. Rush is my favourite band, so that really does my heart pride.
And it still resonates with kids today.
It absolutely, it's great. It's timeless. So much metal music is timeless. Particularly with physicists, I think if you take a Venn diagram of metal fans and physicists, there's a fair degree of overlap there in terms of those two camps. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, with metal in particular, the way you play the guitar, those sort of chugging riffs you play, those sort of squealy harmonics you tease out of the guitar, the drum beats themselves, the sort of the histrionics of the vocals, all of that. Each you can find a parallel with certain aspects of quantum in a little bit more of a entertaining way, I would say, than some other areas of music. And finally, a big motivation was this, is that metal, unfortunately, and this is completely, it's a stereotype and it's a really unfortunate stereotype, but metal is seen to be perhaps not the most intellectually challenging of pursuits or of listening habits, whereas quantum mechanics is certainly seen to be exceptionally intellectually challenging. And I just like the juxtaposition of two of those, something that seemed to be not particularly highbrow with something that seemed to be especially highbrow, when of course anybody who's a metal fan knows that it really is the pinnacle of creativity. So,
and in fact, you point out examples of metal music actually based on mathematical and physics properties, and you actually worked on a song a number of years ago, which we're going to hear a little bit of in a minute, but I'd love you to introduce. This is the Golden Ratio song.
Oh, thank you for playing some of that. That's wonderful. Yeah, so I work with a guy called Brady Haran, who's used to be a BBC video journalist, is now a YouTuber, has got a range of different channels. Numberphile is probably his most successful, which has got, 2.5 million subscribers now, something like that. And Brady and I, in turn, worked with another exceptionally talented guy, a guy called Dave Brown, whose YouTube handle is Boy in a Band. So we took the Golden Ratio, which is a fundamental constant in nature, and we mapped the digits of the Golden Ratio onto an harmonic minor scale, so a particular type of scale in music, which is very, very important in metal. Harmonic minor, really important. It's got that dark sound that is so important in metal. And took the riffs, rhythms, lyrics, and based them on the Golden Ratio, and we had a lot of fun doing that.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that. That's fun to listen to, as well as the fun that you guys had putting that together, actually based on the math. I mean, that doesn't seem like your usual composition mode necessarily for creating music.
No, it doesn't. And what was really interesting is that ticking those digits and transferring across made us play intervals and particular progressions that you just, I think you wouldn't really come up with ordinarily. I think any musician out there, good thing to do is if you want to sort of get those creative juices flowing, perhaps, is to take one of those fundamental constants and map it onto your favorite scale and see what comes out.
Now, obviously, because you're talking about metal music, one of the major themes of the whole book is talking about sound waves. And you get at this one really interesting question. Really early in the book, you introduced this question, and it was one of those moments where I sat there going, you know, I never really thought about that. But once you've introduced the question, how on earth do we know when we hear a piano or a guitar or some other instrument play a note? Why does that note sound different? How do we know that we're hearing a different instrument play that same note? Shouldn't it sound the same no matter what plays it?
Absolutely. So I'm delighted you picked up on that. So I actually, I interview students who apply for our courses at Nottingham, and particularly if there are students who've done physics and music at A level at high school, I ask them that specific question. If you play middle C on guitar and middle C on piano, what is it that means your ear can distinguish the difference? Because if you look at the musical notation, it's the same note.
Yeah, of course.
It's exactly the same note. And what it is, what it's all about, is just how the guitar string or the piano string resonates, how it vibrates. And it can vibrate in a number of different ways. And it's a mixture of those modes of vibration that gives the characteristic sound. So if you were to, you know, record it, the sound of the piano, the sound of the guitar, and look at it, I don't know, on your iPhone or as I'm doing now with a wonderful tool called Audacity, where you can see the sound waves. What you'd see is that it's the same repeat time. So you have a pattern in time that repeats with the same, let's say every millisecond it repeats, or every 10 milliseconds or whatever. But the precise pattern itself will be different. So it's got the same, what we call fundamental frequency, but the actual details of what the wave pattern looks like are different. And that's what allows your ear to detect the difference.
I mean, it's kind of like a heartbeat where we say so many beats per minute, but that beat, if you were to look at an EKG, isn't just one little spike. It's you know, multiple ups and downs to each one of those heartbeats. That note can have all sorts of additional patterns besides just that frequency of the note.
That's exactly it. That's a perfect analogy.
Now, another thing that keeps coming up in the book is something that you even say outright intimidates a lot of mathematicians and physicists. So I kind of hesitate to ask, but I wonder if you've got like a, you know, a 30 or a 60 second quick explanation of Fourier transform and why this keeps coming up in your book and in these explanations of quantum physics.
Okay, so 60 seconds might be a bit of an ask, but I'll do my best. So Fourier transforms and Fourier analysis are absolutely central to so much physics. Unfortunately, you ask somebody who's done a physics degree, or you mention Fourier transforms, and they might run screaming to the hills because it brings back memories of a lot of fairly complicated mathematics. However, the concept itself, if we put aside the maths and the nasty looking integrals, the concept itself is actually very, very straightforward. So it basically is that Fourier told us, and Fourier was a mathematician, physicist a few centuries back, and he had the genius realization that you can represent pretty well any pattern in time or in space by summing up sine waves. So by summing up waves of different heights, so different amplitudes or volume, if you want to put it that way, different frequencies and different phases, which means how the peaks and troughs line up, you can generate pretty well anything you like. And that's that's something that's used throughout physics, you know, in every single aspect of physics. And to the extent where an erstwhile colleague from Nottingham, a guy called Peter Coles, is of the opinion that the vast majority of physicists, when they get hit with a new problem, the very first thing they'll do, they'll drag out of their armory of tools, is a Fourier transform.
When in doubt, Fourier transform.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even more simply, what is it? It's just taking a signal in time and converting it to frequency. Ultimately, that's what Fourier transform does. So every time you see a spectrum analyzer, or you see those bars moving up and down in terms of frequency bands on your iPhone or on a graphic equalizer, that's furry analysis in motion.
Now, we've been talking about math here, but you actually make the case that physics is not just math. And that's maybe one of the things that puts people off about physics is how much math there is. So make the case that physics is more than just math.
I will. And actually, I'm an awful, awful mathematician. My mathematics skills are really poor.
Really?
Absolutely. Really, really, really poor. I'm not good at maths. I have to work really, really hard at it. God, I've got a book here actually in front of me, which I recommend thoroughly by somebody called Sabine Hossenfelder. I actually bought it in Boston, and it's called Lost in Math. And it's actually about the dangers of physicists relying too much on sort of the beauty and the elegance of the mathematical equations. Physics is all about taking that math and making sure that it describes and connects to the real world. You know, when we make empirical measurements, we'll have a mathematical theory that we'd hope explains those measurements and better predicts future measurements. So, yes, I agree that sometimes the mathematical complexity is puts a lot of people off physics, but I use maths in the book, but I hope it's not too daunting. I try to really couch it in terms of really explain it in plain English as well. So I would say that, yes, you can definitely do physics without having a lot of math, but the math makes things a lot more compact and a lot easier to get across to your peers, let's put it that way.
You also mentioned another thing that I've always found a little odd about some explanations in physics and also in other mathematics, which is some of the assumptions that are made. And you actually used this phrase in the book, spherical cows on frictionless surfaces. I mean, how are we supposed to think that physics applies to our everyday life when the examples of how it works are these bizarre things like assuming a cow is a perfect sphere and assuming that it's moving around on a frictionless surface, things that are clearly not reality. I mean, is maybe part of the using metal to explain this a way of getting to something more realistic?
Yeah, I say that with tongue in cheek, but to be fair, that spherical cows on frictionless surfaces, we build up simple models. And this is the beauty of physics. You can build up simple models and you can get an awfully long way, you know, 90% of the way in terms of these idealizations. Then when you add in, you know, you add in a bit of friction, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to dissipate energy. But you can understand a great deal of what's going on from a very simple model. And even if it is a very complex system, the way you build up an understanding is actually to gradually increase the complexity. So you start off with those spherical cows, then you think, okay, I might add a tail. That's still not really describing what I see. Okay, so I'll flatten it in one direction so it's a bit more cylindrical. Maybe that'll do the trick. So it's sort of progression. You've got to start from somewhere, and often, remarkably, that starting place gets you a long way in terms of your understanding, and then you fine-tune your understanding.
I love you have your own model that you use in the book, and it's Marsha the Mosher and how she moves around a mosh pit. I just like saying Marsha the Mosher, but you know, you managed to use a mosh pit and the images that we all have in our heads of what motion in a mosh pit looks like to explain how molecules in a gas move. Maybe something that a few more people relate to than a spherical cow, at least.
Absolutely. Well, there's an interesting local link here as well, because that entire chapter in the book, which is about the dynamics of mosh pits and moshers and how they move and the interactions, is based heavily on the work actually from Harvard from a number of years ago. A guy called Jesse Silverberg and his colleagues produced a paper with the best title ever in a physics journal, actually in Physical Review Letters, which many people would consider is like the most prestigious physics journal alongside Nature Physics, which is something along the lines of collective dynamics of humans in mosh pits at heavy metal concerts. Now, when I saw that title, I was going, that's it. I quit because the bar's been set too high. I'm never going to be able to match that type of scientific analysis. A key aspect of the paper is circle pits, so which I think many are familiar with, and for those who aren't, it sort of does what it says on the tin. You get lots and lots of people circulating in a circle at a heavy metal concert, and they analyse that exactly as you say in the context of molecules in a gas. And the perhaps unsettling thing for heavy metal fans is that the dynamics of people moving at heavy metal concerts, the dynamics of metalers and moshers, can be described exactly using the same physics that we use to describe completely dumb, inanimate, inorganic molecules in a gas.
Having these models, these mental images, and these, you know, stories and analogies to use to teach physics students, I can see absolutely the, you know, the usefulness and why that would be desirable. But can you tell us why you think the rest of us should, you know, take the time to get more familiar with the physics that we have perhaps found so intimidating for so long?
Because it gives you a wonderful insight into how the world works. It improves your understanding of the world, the universe. It helps you really, I would say, even connect with the sort of world around you a little bit more. It's Feynman, Richard Feynman, very famous physicist. It's actually verboten. It's written into every physicist's contract that we're not allowed to have any interview or anything where we don't mention Feynman. So it's so I've got to do that.
I'm glad you got that in there, though.
But Feynman talks about it's in one of his books, talks about, you know, talking with an artist, and the artist is saying, you know, when I describe the flower, or I draw the flower, there's a natural beauty. Why do you physicists and scientists have to come along and spoil that by telling us about how the light waves interact with the flower, or how it absorbs certain colours, or why its texture is like that? And Feynman, I think he echoes every scientist, said, well, no, it's not that it detracts. That understanding doesn't detract. It adds to the beauty. And, you know, there's a strange beauty in metal as well, which I know a lot of people mightn't appreciate who aren't metal fans, but there really is. And I think taking the physics to understand just how, you know, your favourite riffs and your favourite beats are linked in with key concepts in quantum, that increases the beauty of the music. It doesn't detract from it.
Well, on that note, could you give us a suggestion for a song to go out on?
Oh, anything by Rush. So Rush are my favourite band. I would say Natural Science. How about that? It's off Rush's Permanent Waves album.
Sounds perfect. That's Philip Moriarty. He's a professor of physics at the University of Nottingham and author of When the Uncertainty Principle Goes to 11, or How to Explain Quantum Physics with Heavy Metal. He spoke with us via Skype. Philip, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Been a real pleasure.
And that's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening. Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas.